Welcome to the Unsweetened SIO podcast. My name is Siobhan Harris. I am a certified integrative nutrition health coach and the founder of unsweetenedsio.com. I gave up all sugar and all flour on January 13th, 2018, and am finally free of my addiction. My mission is to help other sugar addicts find their path to freedom and live the sweet life without sugar. Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 119 of Unsweetened SIO, the podcast. Today, I have a very special guest with us, Dr. James Mukey. He is an AM and Adelaide-based eye surgeon. He graduated with honors from Adelaide University Medical School in 1988. Following his internship, James lived and worked as a volunteer doctor in Kenya in 1989. After completing ophthalmology training in Adelaide in 1995, James worked as an eye surgeon in Jerusalem for 12 months. He undertook subspecialty training in eye cancer in London, and then returned to Adelaide in 1998, where he has been a visiting consultant and senior lecturer at Royal Adelaide and Women's and Children's Hospitals. James has taught the diagnosis and management of eye cancer in 10 countries in Asia. He founded not-for-profit organization Sight for All in 2008, turning his boundless energy into a fight against blindness in the Aboriginal and mainstream communities of Australia and some of the poorest countries of the world. Sight for All's comprehensive and sustainable projects are now impacting on the lives of over 1 million people each year. His commitment to social impact and humanitarian endeavors has earned him a number of awards, including an Order of Australia in 2012, the Australian Medical Association's President's Leadership Award in 2013, and Ernst & Young Social Entrepreneur for Australia in 2015. James is Australian of the Year for 2020 for his 32 years of humanitarian work. He is using this powerful platform to raise awareness of our poor diet, laden with sugary drinks and ultra processed foods, which is devastating the health of Australians. And I will add to that, devastating the health of Americans and many other countries as well. So welcome, James. So glad to have you here today with us.
Thanks, Siobhan. Great to be here. It's actually devastating the entire world, isn't it? It's not just
down here. Exactly. Very, very impressive bio there. Australian of the Year for 2020. That must have been a huge honor.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting, actually. And then not long after I received the award, which was in Australia Day last year, which is the 26th of January, of course, the COVID-19 hit us all. And what was to be an extraordinary opportunity for me and for Sight for All to put our organization on the map really completely dissolved away, which was so frustrating and so disappointing. But I, you know, made the most of the role. And in the end, I had to be quite proactive about it because everyone was so completely consumed by COVID-19 that the last thing that they wanted to hear was to cut back on your sugar intake.
Exactly, which ironically is the advice they really needed to hear to help, you know, their immune systems. I always thought that was interesting how we weren't really talking about eating better, you know, during the pandemic and better choices that you could make nutritionally. So that didn't really come up.
Absolutely. In fact, I met with our health minister last year. I met with our shadow health minister. I met with our state health minister and our state shadow health minister. I was even on the COVID-19 advisory group early last year when I received the award. And to each of them, I said, should we not be focusing on our diet? Because the people who were really suffering and dying from this disease were people with chronic diseases such as type 2 diabetes. And throughout the year, and excuse me, into this year as well, I've been just repeating the fact that improving our metabolic poor health is the best weapon that we have against COVID.
Definitely. Yes, I agree 100%. So I'm sure you see a lot of patients with diabetes, you know, being an eye surgeon. So you really get, you know, see firsthand what sugar does, you know, to the eyes in particular. So I'd love for you just to kind of just dive in a little bit with, you know, just your history, maybe just a little bit more of your background and really how that's become, you know, such a, you know, something that you're really trying to help people understand, you know, just the effects that it does have and changes that we can all make, you know, so that people aren't going blind, because I'm sure you have found that it's preventable in a lot of cases.
Yeah, exactly. So I won the award, as you read out in the intro, because of my work with Sight for All. And in many poorer parts of the world, there's quite simply not the resources, the trained personnel to be able to deal with health problems, I mean, including eye problems. I mean, I'm an ophthalmologist, I'm an eye surgeon, so my focus is on fighting blindness. But each of these countries are really struggling through across all of the specialty areas. But in terms of my history, so I was born in Adelaide. I moved to Canberra, the capital city of Australia, when I was five. Went to high school there, missed out on Sydney University Medicine by one mark, and then ended up coming back to Adelaide, which was my original home, and undertook medical school here. And then, as you mentioned, I went and spent a year working as a voluntary doctor in Kenya, which really, at that stage, was something that was quite an extraordinary experience. And we can talk about that a little later if you like. But it was it really forged in me a passion to work in poor countries. And, you know, the idea, I was very keen on surgery and particularly microsurgery. So the thought of actually using microsurgery, using my hands to restore blindness, to fight blindness, which was particularly focused on cataract blindness, which is the leading cause of blindness in the world, that was something that really appealed. So I returned to Adelaide in 1990, actually, and then I took my eye training here in Adelaide, and thereafter went to work in Jerusalem, as you mentioned, and that really cemented a passion for fighting blindness in poor communities, and particularly the work we were doing out in the regional areas and the refugee camps of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, helping people there. Went on to London and studied eye cancer, and then returned to Australia in 1998, where I've been ever since. So really, to continue my love of fighting blindness in poorer communities, I started getting involved in a number of research and educational projects throughout Asia. You know, Asia is home to half the world's blind adults and two-thirds of the world's blind kids. So it was an area that was desperately in need. And so I've been teaching and working there for many, many years. And really, that grew into or evolved into Sight for All, which was launched in 2008. And as you've mentioned again, that we're now impacting on over a million people every year through the sustainable and comprehensive educational projects that we have running there. Now, what's interesting, back in 2007, I was involved in an adult blindness study in Myanmar in Southeast Asia. And it was one of the largest blindness studies ever undertaken. And actually, it found the highest prevalence of blindness. Nearly 1 in 10 adults over the age of 40 were blind, but that mainly were due to cataract blindness. We didn't see a single patient with type 2 diabetes. We didn't see any patients with diabetic retinopathy. So that was extraordinary. This is a regional area of the country, but what we know in those urban centers in Asia, type 2 diabetes is skyrocketing. In China, for example, there's been more than a tenfold increase in type 2 diabetes in the last 40 years. But if we come back to Australia, we also have an element of our work here in this country, which is really focused on raising awareness. Unlike poor communities, where healthcare is perhaps not free in most of these countries, and access to healthcare is not always available, particularly in remote and regional areas. Here in Australia and in the States, we have, in Australia, we have a free healthcare system, Medicare, and we have eye specialists and optometrists going out to even the most remote communities on a regular basis. So accessibility, affordability is not an issue here. What is an issue is awareness. And then that brings us really to the story of type 2 diabetes, which makes up about 90% of cases of diabetes. And it's now impacting on about 1.7 million people in this country of 25 million. But what we do know is that there is another 2 million with pre-diabetes. And I'm sure you're aware of the very concerning fact that in the States, it's something like 88% of people are metabolically unhealthy. And we know we're not far behind that, with over two thirds of Australian adults overweight or obese. So type 2 diabetes is skyrocketing in this country as it is across the world. And what I've noticed in my own practice, although I'm an eye cancer specialist, you can imagine eye cancer is pretty rare, but what we're all noticing in our general ophthalmology practice is the increasing numbers of patients every year who we are treating for the blinding complications of type 2 diabetes. I'm seeing patients who are losing vision, even going blind due to this disease, this largely avoidable man-made dietary disease. So it's been a really, really concerning thing for me to see in my practice. But what's interesting is that really for the last 20 odd years that I've been working and dealing with this disease here, I only ever saw myself as the guy at the end of the line treating the blinding complications. I never thought it was my role to talk or to explore even what were the underlying cause, what was the root cause, which was our poor diet. I always thought that was the role of the GP, the nutritionist, the dietitian, the exercise physiologist, whoever was dealing with that side of things. And really, things took a turn for me in late 2018. I was involved in putting a little documentary together about the experience of blindness, what it means to lose vision, to be blind. And I actually interviewed 4 children who were born blind, 4 adults who are slowly going blind toward the end of their lives, and 2 in the middle of their life who suddenly went blind due to their diabetes. And one of those people was a guy named Neil Hansel, who went to bed one evening at the age of 50 and woke up the next morning blind in both eyes and remains blind to this day. And his story was so impactful for me that I really started to dig in deeper to the whole story. And that's a little bit of background to get things started anyway, Siobhan.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much for going into all of that. I'm really curious, just kind of where you ended too, to pick up there, like what you found as you started really digging in and seeing the link between nutrition and you know, diabetes, and, you know, how did you start kind of raising more awareness around that?
Yeah, so Neil's story was a tragic one, and he started earning money at the age of 16, and he had a busy job when he was on the run, and he was thin and fit, and he was consuming about 4 liters of soft drink a day. He didn't realize he was doing himself harm, or potentially doing himself harm, and he was diagnosed 10 years later at the age of 26. So on average, it takes about 13 years for adults to develop type 2 diabetes, but in kids, they can actually develop it in as little as 2 years. So he developed type 2 diabetes, and then again, he wasn't aware of what might lay waiting for him if he didn't curb his poor diet. And, you know, he progressed in his life, he had 4 children and a wife who also developed type 2 diabetes, and was really focused on providing care for them and neglecting himself. And that's why he had neglected his eye health. And we know with diabetes, diabetic retinopathy or diabetes related eye disease is the potential outcome, the vision threatening or blinding outcome of this disease if the patient is neglecting their health and their eye health. So what we know with patients with diabetes is, because there is a risk of losing vision, they need to have regular eye checks. So if a patient has diabetes, or if they're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, they have to have an eye check immediately, because we don't know for how long they might have had their type 2 diabetes leading up to that. You know, the patient with type 1 diabetes, that's an acute autoimmune disease, and no one will have retinopathy at diagnosis. So we generally will undertake the first eye exam roughly 5 years after diagnosis. But type 2, immediately patients need to have their eyes checked. And then they need to have their eyes checked regularly throughout their life because of this risk. We know that 98% of the loss of vision and blindness due to type 2 diabetes, due to diabetes in general, actually, is preventable or treatable. the patients need to have their eyes checked on a regular basis. Now, if they are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, they should get an eye check with their optometrist or with their eye specialist, their eye surgeon, their ophthalmologist. And if there is no sign of disease, well, that's great. They should be seen probably every 18 months to 2 years. If there is early changes of retinopathy, then they should have a check every year. If they do have vision-threatening retinopathy, then they may need treatment immediately, or they may need more close follow-up. The problem is in Australia, and I suspect in the States and other parts of the world would be even worse, but in Australia, well over half of the 1.7 million with type 2 diabetes are not having these eye checks. And so what's happened here in this country is that diabetes, and specifically type 2 diabetes, has become the leading cause of blindness amongst working age adults. So it's very, very concerning. So in late 2019, I was fortunate enough to receive the Australian of the Year Award for South Australia. And when I made my speech, I was using the platform to encourage people to have their eyes checked so that we could turn this really concerning issue around. But when I was going forward then to the national ceremony, so you have to receive the local or the state award before you go on to the national ceremony, I was not expecting to win the award, absolutely not expecting to win the award, but you have to prepare for it. And so I started thinking about it more deeply and realizing the role of our poor diet in type 2 diabetes. And so when I made my speech, it was really then focused on our poor diet and specifically sugar and ultra processed foods. And that's what I have been doing really for the last nearly 2 years. I've been living and breathing this very, very fascinating, but very challenging and at times stressful world that I've landed myself in, kind of unwittingly, really. You can see why I'm so passionate about it when we see 1.7 million in this country. We're seeing it in children in Australia. There's as young as six. In fact, there was a newspaper article recently that said Northern Australia leads the world for type 2 diabetes in young children. Mm-hmm. That's not something to be proud about. In our First Nations people, in our Aboriginal people, we have had an 80-fold increase in type 2 diabetes over the past 40 years. We're seeing poorer parts of this country, Greater Western Sydney, for example, where half of the adults have either pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes. So it's really, really concerning. And so I've been using the platform to raise awareness, to hold businesses and industry and ultimately our government to account on what's going on here.
Yeah, that's amazing. Such a good use of your platform. Like you said, not necessarily where you thought you were going to be diving into, but you know, you have the platform. And so you're doing that. And I think that it's so needed too. So I'm really grateful that you are raising the awareness. And that's so sad to me about, you know, the statistics that you're giving really are, wow, like, especially about kids and even that they can get diabetes in as little as 2 years just from, you know, poor diet and all the, like you said, you know, ultra processed food, sugar, but all the sugary drinks too, you know, of people that just don't even think about, even juice, you know, that has a lot of sugar in it too. It's just something that we think is, you know, giving to kids under 2 years old, you know.
Absolutely. All those energy drinks, flavored milks. Actually, orange juice was recently downgraded. We have a health star rating system, which is a flawed system anyway. It's only 30% of manufacturers use it, but it's actually an industry device created by industry for industry. But orange juice was downgraded recently from 5 stars to 2 stars. That's something that's taken years to happen. There's been a group that's been working ferociously on that to try and turn it around. But you know, how can a glass of orange juice, which has almost as much sugar as a glass of cola, for example, how could it possibly receive the healthiest rating? So this is just one of many products, many drinks, many foods and many food-like substances that need to be corrected.
Yeah. Well, just so much reprogramming to do too. Cause even when I just talk to people about, you know, like if you're going to drink a juice, you might as well just have soda. And they're like, no, juice is healthy. You know, there's so much reprogramming, I think, that needs to happen to re-education. And like really kind of looking at you know, that actually it's not healthy for you. Because that's what we've been told. That's what a lot of people grew up with. That was part of a nutritious breakfast, like orange juice, for example, in particular. But now I think finally there's a lot of new evidence and research coming out and a lot more people like you talking about it and trying to change that so that people, but I don't know what you come up against as you educate people about this, but even just when I'm talking with people, there's still a lot of resistance to that.
Oh, there sure is. Absolutely. Even in my practice and my nursing staff as well, you know, I've given my major presentation, which I've been delivering for the last couple of years and which has evolved over the last couple of years, actually. But I gave it to them early last year just as a rehearsal, really, and talking about, full fat dairy or full cream dairy milk. And saying that this is a healthier option than the low-fat dairy, because the low-fat dairy may well be full of sugar and carbs to enhance its flavor. And once you strip the fat out of it, and yet we still have skim milk in our fridge, and you know, and we still have cream biscuits and cookies, what you call cookies, in our tea room. We still have cakes on a regular basis for birthday parties. So, you know, even my highly educated nursing staff, we still, and the fact that I'm talking about this and many of them are following me on social media, there's still this kind of ingrained thought that the diet that we have been consuming for the last 50 years is the good diet. And you know, I think some of those things that people inherently know is that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. But in fact, I gave a community presentation recently, and there was 300-400 people, and I said, who's heard the expression breakfast is the most important meal of the day? And they all put up their hands. Everyone's heard it. But this was something that was coined and popularized by John Harvey Kellogg in 1906 to market his newly invented breakfast cereal, cornflakes. Yeah, surely one of the most enduring marketing campaigns ever. And yet there's not a shred of evidence to say that we need cereal for brekkie. In fact, many of us will do better without cereal for brekkie. So that's something that's absolutely fascinating. And the other thing is that that people tend to know is that saturated fat is bad for us. But actually, there's no strong evidence whatsoever. In fact, a number of recent studies have shown that there is no link between natural saturated fat, which is found in products such as unprocessed meat, and particularly red meat, but also full fat dairy, eggs, even dark chocolate, not linked to cardiovascular disease. So what we've known and what people have thought for so long is actually completely wrong. And yet, you know, even myself, I find myself, rather than if I have a slice of whole grain bread every now and then, you know, I'll put butter on it rather than margarine, because I know it's healthier. But there's still something inside you, sort of, there is something there that's still slightly concerning, because you've had this drilled into you for so long. So it's going to take a long time, I suspect, to reverse this psychology.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Especially around the fat is the other big thing where people, I mean, that was the very first diet I went on, was very, very low fat, which happened to be very high sugar, but, that wasn't talked about. And we wouldn't worry about the sugar. It was that the fat was the problem. So still, when I work with clients and encourage healthy fats, that diet mentality around it, it's really hard to get people to be, you know, I especially with like an avocado, you know, I have always, people are like, well, are you sure it's okay for me to have more than like a quarter? Like, they're so worried about the calories and keeping the fat down, and just not realizing that it's actually such a healthy food for them. So yeah, there's a lot of, I think, reprogramming that we have to do. And I know, as far as like, for me too, like, that was hard for me to realize and to trust, oh my gosh, I'm eating more fat. Am I going to gain more weight? You know, but as I found how much it improved, you know, my overall health, I think it's like, you know, one of those things, one by one, that people are going to start making these changes, start talking about it. Friends and family are going to see the improvements, and hopefully, you know, we all kind of start down this healthier track. Cause I do think there's a lot more awareness now, that it is really our poor diet causing a lot of these diseases, and, you know, like diabetes, and that are totally preventable with better nutrition. So when you have people coming to you, I'm just curious, like, how because it's really overwhelming for people, I think, to get started too. When they, you know, how do you kind of work with people and, you know, suggest that they even get started when it comes to like looking at how much sugar they're having and maybe making some changes in their diet?
Yeah. So it's amazing, as I mentioned, sort of for 32 years that I've been working in this space, the growth of patients with type 2 diabetes, I now have over 100 patients who I'm actively treating with vision-threatening diabetic retinopathy. In fact, there are over 100,000 patients in this country with vision-threatening retinopathy. But I'm talking about the ones that I'm actively treating. I'm injecting into their eyes. I'm lasering their eyes. So they're active treatment patients. And I've got a lot of others that I'm just watching regularly to ensure they don't develop that outcome. But of those patients, what I've done since the beginning of this year is ask each of them, are you aware that your type 2 diabetes can be put into remission? And I reckon there was only one, perhaps two of that 100 that were even aware that their disease could be put into remission. We now know type 2 diabetes can be put into remission. There are over 100 controlled clinical trials to show that this is the case, and there are a number of ways we can do it. There are three clinically proven methods, but just going back to those patients. So what I would do was say, look, you know, again, it wasn't my role. I'm really dealing with the complications, and there's enough discussion, counseling, and treatment for that rather than for me to spend time talking about diet. But I do touch on it with them, and I say, look, there is a way of putting your diabetes into remission. I think it's important to go back and chat to your general practitioner and explore the possibility with them. And so I'll write then to the GP saying, can you please explore the opportunity to put this patient's diabetes into remission using a low carbohydrate, a ketogenic diet, and then basically leave it in the hands of the GP then to do that. I actually recommend a nutritionist who specializes this in my city. And it's been honestly one of the most exciting, thrilling experiences of my medical life to see patients come back. So with the patients who are receiving regular injections, it's not just a one-off thing, to see them come back to me, you know, maybe 3 months later with their diabetes in remission. So they've actually come off their insulin, they've come off their oral medications, they've lost a bunch of weight, they've seen better, they've never felt better. It's just, you know, thrilling to experience this, of something that we've been told until quite recently, this is a progressive disease. In fact, till earlier this year, Diabetes Australia, the first sentence in their type 2 diabetes page was type 2 diabetes is a progressive disease. So yeah, wonderful, wonderful experience. Now, I've only been focusing on my patients with vision-threatening retinopathy because of all the nutritionists and dietitians in my city. There's only a small number that have experience and have the ability to really manage a low carb diet in patients with type 2 diabetes who are on a bunch of medications. So I'm starting off with these patients, and I've been pressuring Dietitians Australia to take this on board now, that this is really critical with 1.7 million Australians with type 2 diabetes and another two with pre-diabetes, and they have over 7,000 dietitians across the country. They really should take this in hand. This is critical time for them to actually provide their members with clinical practice guidelines to be able to put patients with type 2 diabetes, put them into remission. So it's really, really important. So I've started off with these patients, but ultimately everyone with type 2 diabetes needs this proper counselling. And if it's not coming from the government, and if the awareness raising is not happening at that level, it actually has to come from the ground up. And it's exciting to see this groundswell starting to happen now. We've recently had a documentary series in Australia, which is called Australia's Health Revolution, where we were talking about remission of type 2 diabetes. There's been quite a number of newspaper articles that I've been involved in to raise awareness. We now have remission of type 2 diabetes in our national diabetes strategy for the very first time because of my advocacy. That's only just been released in the last month. So, and that will give GPs and dietitians, nutritionists comfort that they can actually have these really important discussions with their patients. We have had doctors in this country, we've had dietitians in this country who have been basically struck off their regulatory bodies because of having discussions with patients recommending that they reduce their sugar, reduce their carb intake. But this is absolutely the advice that patients with type 2 should have. This is a disease of carbohydrate intolerance. So this is exactly the discussions we need to be having.
Yeah, so good just to be having those discussions, like you're saying, and even just asking, you know, telling your patients, do you know that this is reversible? I mean, yeah, again, I think so many people aren't aware of how much they can do for their own health, like how much they're really in charge of their own health, because we're just so used to going to a doctor, doing what they tell us to do. And at least here in the US, a lot of times diet isn't talked about, you know? So I think, again, getting more and more people aware and asking for that, well, you know, I've heard that a low carb diet can help, low sugar. The more kind of we're requesting that and having that demand, I'm hoping that, yeah, like you were talking about, more dietitians, nutritionists, even GPs will get, you know, be able to give out that information. So I think that's sometimes frustrating that I see here is people, and I know it was my own experience where I wanted help, but wasn't getting the right help, you know, for what I needed. But I do feel like I can feel a shift of that help happening. And just by all of those things that you're doing, it's really getting that in motion. So I just think that's really, really powerful.
It's absolutely fascinating, because I'm getting a little bit of pushback, you know, of those 100 odd patients that I've written to their GPs. Some are ignoring my letter. Certainly they're not embracing the recommendations that I'm giving. And others who have, let's say, a little hesitantly gone with their patient's request to explore this and actually put their diabetes into remission, they've been red-faced. I've had some endocrinologists, endocrine doctors, who have actually disowned their patients who have suggested that they want to try low carb to put their diabetes into remission. So it's extraordinary out there. But as I said before, the fact that we now have remission in our national diabetes strategy hopefully will give people comfort that they can actually progress with this and give those patients comfort and also the doctors that they're not going to be vilified as a result of those having these discussions. So, you know, what's the other really important thing is that we know that low carb healthy fat works. As I mentioned, over 100 controlled clinical trials. What we also know is that the current dietary recommendation, which still exists in our national dietary guidelines, which is essentially a high carb, low fat recommendation, which is really based on the American dietary guidelines from 1980. We know that that does not, there's no evidence to suggest that that can put type 2 diabetes into remission. So we need a complete turnaround of that national policy. And our dietary guideline review committee, or the review process, has just begun. And that's going to take about 4 years, 3 or 4 years to be released. In the meantime, we will have over 100,000 new patients every year being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. We'll have over 15,000 deaths due to type 2 diabetes. So we absolutely need to see an awareness strategy, a broad awareness strategy across social and mainstream media to raise awareness amongst patients of this really critical information.
Yeah, so grateful again for people like you and Dr. Robert Lustig here in the US that's just really bringing the attention to it so that we can start seeing some forward movement and improvements. I'm curious too, because, you know, I don't know a lot about blindness. When, you know, people, you're saying, you know, within 3 months of maybe changing their diet, they're able to start seeing, you know, reversing their diabetes significantly, can start getting off medication. Are they able to improve their vision too? Like if there is some blindness already occurring because of diabetes, is it possible to get any of that back, or how does that work for eye health?
Yeah, it's a great question. So We know that this is a continuum, and as the blood sugar rises, we move into the pre-diabetes level and then into the type 2 diabetes level. But I have seen patients with pre-diabetes who have retinopathy, so it can start in patients before they're formally diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And just looking at the complications, the eye complications, which are actually the most feared of all the complications of type 2, and type 2, there are so many complications, it's staggering. This is a disease that impacts on the entire body, life-changing and life-threatening complications. The second most feared is amputation of the leg due to gangrene. The guy I mentioned earlier, Neil Hansel, had 9 amputations over a 14-month period leading up to the complete removal of his left leg in March last year. He's also had 2 heart attacks. So this is a deadly disease. So going back to the eyes, what can happen is you can get blockage of blood vessels of the retina, and this can trigger this ischemia, can trigger the ingrowth of abnormal blood vessels trying to heal that area of retina which is lacking in oxygen flow. And those blood vessels are fragile, and they can bleed. And as in the case of Neil Hansel, he had bleeding to both eyes at the very same time overnight, which is an unusual story. It would usually present in one eye, and it may present as a sudden loss of vision or just shadows and floaters and blurring like that. That would be a more common presentation. And generally, when we have bleeding into the eye, occasionally the patients will need surgery to remove the blood and then have to treat those abnormal blood vessels with a type of laser treatment called photocoagulation. So the other and more common complication is what we call diabetic macular edema. The macula is the central vision area of the retina, and diabetes damages the fine blood vessels, and the blood vessels become leaky at the central vision area, and leakage of fluid into the tissues of the retina can cause blurring and distortion of vision. So until about 10, 15 years ago, we used to treat that with laser, and we still do use laser to treat that to try and stimulate reabsorption of the fluid at the retina at the central vision area. Now we have an injection of an antibody. It's called anti-VEGF, anti-vascular endothelial growth factor. We inject that into the vitreous of the eye under local anesthesia. And the idea of that is that it seals up the leaky blood vessels, hopefully allows that fluid to reabsorb and the vision to stabilize, or hopefully in some cases improve. But with the injections, it's not a one-off injection, and the patients may require ongoing injections for the rest of their life. Sometimes we're able to wean them off and keep them off injections for a period of time. And in those patients, we're really just dealing with what we're dealing with is the edema, the swelling, which is collecting at the central vision area. What we're not dealing with is the root cause, which again, we come back to diet. So if we can have that patient at the same time as they're receiving their treatment, also reducing their intake of sugar, added sugars, ultra-processed foods, refined carbohydrates. Basically, if we're cutting back on their intake of sugar and of seed oils, which are also harmful, if we can cut back on those, then at the same time, it may allow the retina to repair itself. So this is a really interesting thing that has not been explored. I've had a PhD student who's just started now recruiting patients to see if a low-carb diet can actually reverse retinopathy. But it makes sense to me. Some patients, unfortunately, now I can't give any promises that it will work, but some patients who have advanced disease, such as in the case of Neil Hansel, we're not going to be able to reverse their retinopathy or restore their sight. But many patients, I suspect, I hope, will be able to at least remove the toxic impact of the sugar, particularly the fructose element, and also the toxic impact of the seed oils in driving the vascular damage. If we can actually minimize the insult of that, then hopefully it'll allow the retina to heal itself. And I'll be really thrilled to see if that happens over the coming months.
Yeah, that's really exciting to look into. What about for people that don't have diabetes? Do you know, like, how does like removing sugar still benefit their eye health? I guess, have you seen, cases of that where you know, for someone? Does it help, you know, their, if their vision has been, you know, slightly getting worse and worse and worse, have you found that if they are changing their diet, it at least maybe it doesn't get better, but at least stops that progression from going as quickly?
Yeah. So if a patient does not have diabetes and does not have any eye disease, I mean, I think in terms of the entire body, reducing our intake of sugars, and I mentioned the seed oils, can only be a good thing. And you may be aware of Chris Kenobi, I think that's how he pronounces it, or K-N-O-B-B-E. He's an ophthalmologist in the States who is convinced that the seed oils are driving a condition called age-related macular degeneration, which is the leading cause of blindness in elderly. In fact, it's in high-income countries or developed countries. And in Australia, it's the leading cause of blindness in adults. He's convinced that seed oils are driving this. So that once again, and it's all come back to our poor diet, and particularly a diet which is high in ultra processed foods. We know in the States, I think that something like 62% of the calories of the adult diet is ultra processed food, and something like 2/3, I saw in a recent article, is ultra processed foods. And I suspect we're close to 50% here in Australia. So those ultra processed foods are high in sugar. We know sugar is addictive. They're also high in refined carbohydrates and seed oil. So these food-like substances that have been created by industry, to me, are like a loaded gun pointing directly at our liver and driving metabolic dysfunction. So it's terribly concerning. Interesting, now, I came up early last year before I received the award. I was doing a lot of reading and thinking about it and coming up with strategies to try and mitigate the risk or to turn this around. And I came up with something I call the 5 A's of sugar toxicity. I'm not sure if you've heard that. The first A is addiction. So sugar is highly addictive, shown to be as addictive as nicotine. Second A is alleviation. We often use sugar to alleviate stress or to make us feel better when we're down. Third A is accessibility. Sugar is cheap and literally everywhere in our lives these days. You know, you can't walk into a gas station without being confronted by a wall of confectionery. You can't check out from most supermarket stores, even post offices, even chemists these days, without being enticed by half-price sugary drinks and chocolates and candy. Fourth A is addition. Something like 75% of our food and drinks have added sugar. And this is really problematic in remote communities, and particularly in First Nations people in our Aboriginal communities. And the fifth A is advertising. You know, we are completely bombarded by TV commercials and ads for sugary products on a regular and daily basis. And so it's these five A's which are really driving us, and I think it's a great way of also thinking of strategies to potentially come out of it to reverse it. So it's
exactly addressing each of those, you know, one by one. I haven't heard you say that before. I really, it's so true, all of those things, so true. I mean, even like I was in a clothing store the other day for kids, and there was candy at like the checkout. And I'm like, really? Like, why is that necessary here? Just crazy. And the advertising, especially directed at kids, you know, in particular, you know, it's very frustrating as a parent of young kids to see that. And it is. Yeah.
Actually, in Australia, our kids are exposed to 3 TV commercials in every hour for unhealthy food stuff. And on social media, teens are exposed to something like 100 promotions for unhealthy foods every week. So kids are particularly being targeted by industry. So this is what I call predatory marketing. And they're preying on not just our kids and their parents, because parents, when you're at the checkout counter and your kid's jumping up and down, they want that half price chocolate. It's and often the parent will buy the chocolate just to keep the kid quiet. But it's also preying on the vulnerable and people who are physically dependent on sugary products or even addicted to sugary products or ultra processed foods. And I know I've had a physical dependency. It's very, very tough to break. And I know when I'm at a checkout counter and there's half price chocolates or 2-for-1 chocolate deal calling out to me, and it really does, it calls out to you. And in the past, I've bought both of those chocolates and eaten both of them before I got home. So it's incredibly powerful. And the food industry, and particularly the ultra processed food industry, absolutely knows what they're doing.
Oh, definitely. And I like that you brought up social media, actually. That's such a good point. How many ads are on there? You know, I'm kind of newer to social media and had no idea. I'm thinking, you know, most people are streaming TV. They're not watching ads, thinking, you know, but there's other ways now to still get to us. And I'm always amazed by the amount, even on my own feed, on my social media, just being bombarded, you know, by, the food. So didn't even think about, for kids, especially teenagers that are on and seeing these same things. So,
And then you walk out the front door and go to the bus stop, and there's an ad for ultra processed food on the bus shelter. And then the bus goes past and there's ad for ultra processed food and sugary drinks on the bus going past. I mean, it literally everywhere. And once you actually start to look for it, you just see it everywhere. It's quite extraordinary. Once you see it, it's very hard to unsee it.
Yeah, no, that is so true. And I just want to touch on just quickly, because you mentioned, I was going to ask you how your diet has changed or evolved, you know, through all your work and seeing all this stuff. You kind of mentioned, you know, you were a little more dependent on sugar before. Have you really seen your own diet improve as you've kind of, you know, learned more and more about this?
Oh, yeah. In fact, early last year, before I received the award, and again, when I was thinking about it and preparing for the potential opportunity to be Australian of the Year and use the platform to talk about type 2 diabetes and our poor diet, I thought, well, gosh, if I'm gonna practice what I preach, in essence, you know, if I'm gonna walk the talk, I better cut back on my intake of sugar and sugary drinks and refined carbs and ultra processed foods, and I did just that, and in fact, I've done it a couple of times before. I did it in the past when I was having trouble sleeping, thinking that that might be driving poor sleep. And then I became addicted again. But early last year, it was a 3-day, pretty unpleasant process. But I persisted with it. And fortunately, as I said, received the award. And then we went into the lockdown, and we had a 2-month period in Adelaide when we had that, you know, that very first lockdown. Luckily, we've done quite well in Adelaide. In fact, the pandemic hasn't even hit yet, although we're close to sort of 80-90% vaccination rate. So going into the lockdown and then just continuing with that diet, and for me, it wasn't, you know, a strict or major thing. It was really just giving up the fruit juices, the soft drinks, the gin and tonics. You know, I have a whiskey rather than a gin and tonic these days. The candy, the cakes, biscuits, and just really giving up the heavily sugared product and just being a bit more conscious about, you know, jams. I think what you call jellies and sauces and condiments which are full of sugar. Just being a little conscious of that, and rather than having pasta, rice, or potatoes every night, just cutting back on that. And I lost about 15 kilograms over that first couple of months. And then we came out of the lockdown, and I had friends come out to me, and they were quite staggered at my weight loss. And they were whispering in my ear, "Are you okay? You know, do you have a nasty disease? Do you have a cancer?" Because I'd lost so much weight. And I said, "No, I think this is just the way I'm meant to look." And it's sort of become normalized. And I certainly had a bit of the belly, but I'm 6'4", I'm tall and I'm thin. But then not long after that, I had a sore back, and I had a scan just to make sure that there was nothing nasty going on there. And they discovered that I had a fatty liver. So there's no doubt. And I put a post up recently of what my diet was prior to early last year. And it was quite staggering compared to what my diet is now. But a fatty liver is key to this whole metabolic dysfunction. So I had a fatty liver, and I'm tall and thin. I'm what they call toffee, so thin on the outside, fat on the inside. Whereas what we should be aspiring to is being hotty, is HOTI, healthy on the outside and thin on the inside. And I've fortunately managed to maintain that. But, you know, I'm not hardline about this, and I'm certainly not cheery about it. I think for me, and we go out to dinner regularly, or you go to a friend's house and they'll serve up a dessert. And I'm not hard. I won't sort of, you know, refuse to have a dessert. I'll still have a dessert and enjoy it every now and then. It's just, you know, the thing that I've had my entire life, my passion, my weakness really, is ice cream. And there's rarely been a day up until early last year when I didn't have a huge bowl of ice cream after dinner every night. And I've got a son who's at home still. One of my sons has left home, but the other one is in his early 20s. He's actually in medical school. And an interesting aside, he just finished third year medicine yesterday, but last year in second year medicine, he had the opportunity to do nutrition as an elective. So it's not even compulsory in many of our medical schools, and yet this is the biggest health crisis that we have, which is a whole other story. But occasionally ice cream does creep into the fridge, and it's always calling out to me. But now that I've largely detoxed from sugar, it's much easier to walk past the fridge and not be seduced by the ice cream there.
Well, that's amazing. That's so good to hear, you know, and you touched on so many good points there about, you know, just because you look a certain way or weigh a certain amount doesn't mean that your inside is healthy, you know? So I'm so glad that you saw all those improvements. And also really interesting about your son. And yeah, because I'm happy to hear that nutrition is even a elective. Because I know when I talk to a lot of doctors and nurses here in the States, they say, oh yeah, we didn't even cover nutrition at all. So I'm glad to hear that it's at least, you know, an elective, and that'd be a whole other episode with your son. I'd be very curious what he's learned, you know, what they're teaching them too around nutrition, but glad it does feel like, again, I think my message from all of this is just hope. Like it feels like, you know, hopeful for the first time in a while that things are changing, that things are going to get better, that we are going to be reversing this, that, you know, people are going to get the help that they need. And that's a big thanks, you know, to you and using your platform to start with, you know, because awareness is just the first step before any change can be made. So really, really grateful for all that you've done. We are pretty much out of time, so I just wanted to check back in and see if there's anything maybe that we didn't touch on that you know, I know there was so much more that we could have talked about today. It always goes too fast, but is there anything else that maybe you wanted to talk about, or any kind of last words of advice, or, you know, anything you kind of just takeaways for people listening today?
Yeah, a couple of things, and you just touched on it then. And I think from Robert Lustig's work, there are now more thin metabolically unhealthy people than there are overweight or obese metabolically unhealthy people. So obesity is not it's a marker for poor metabolic health, but it's not the main driver or the main issue here. It's not even the number of calories, but it's the type of calories that we're consuming, which is so important. So this whole fat shaming, you know, is definitely something that we need to be aware of, because when you realize that this is a disease impacting on more thin people, then we all need to stand up and take note. And the other thing that which I think is so critical is Gary Fick. He's I'm not sure if Gary's been on your show, but Gary's a great person to have a chat to. So Gary was an orthopedic surgeon who was struck off by our medical board back in 2012 for telling his patients to cut back on their sugar intake, because he was amputating legs of patients with type 2 every week. And it's an extraordinary story in itself. And Gary has come up with the phrase, eat fresh, local, seasonal, whole food, which is relevant to your environment and to your cultural background, and avoiding added sugars and ultra-processed foods. And I think if we all did that, then we'd be in a much better place. And I think that's quite a nice way to finish.
Oh, that's perfect. I love that so much. And I'm going to have to look Gary up, because, yeah, that his story sounds fascinating as well. So thank you again so much for being here today and talking with us. I just find this all so fascinating. So thank you so much.
And thanks for all you're doing too, Siobhan. All the best.
Yep. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. And remember, life is so much sweeter without sugar.